Good afternoon, everyone. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. And in this hour of the broadcast, we're going to take a look at the foreign policy record of President Barack Obama. As the president approaches the end of his second term, seems like a good time to, well, maybe kind of put together a report card on how he has done with foreign affairs. We'll have two guests on during this hour, one guest who says he's been doing a great job and another guest who has a different view. We'll start with Gideon Rose, who is the editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine and the Peter G. Peterson Chair. And Gideon Rose, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks for joining me today.
Good to be here, John.
So in your article, you compare the role of the president with regard to foreign policy as to that of, say, a member of a relay team, or it may be a more appropriate metaphor for this time of year, a middle relief pitcher. What do you mean by that?
You know, a lot of people think of presidents in terms of one big decision or a decisive action, like a swing of the bat or a pitch. But really, the game started, it was in progress when the president comes in and the president hands off to somebody else. And so what you're really doing as president is you're trying to make sure that your team keeps the lead or stays in the game while you're pitching. And it's a stint in a longer effort. And you're a key player, but you're not the only one. There's both an opposing team and other players on your team. So you don't have total control of the situation, but you have a lot of things. And so I think that, you know, a middle relief pitcher isn't particularly a glorious occupation in baseball, but it's a very important one. And there are special statistics used to judge their performance, the hold or the blown save. And that's, I think, the kind of way we should think about what a president actually does. Because if you're evaluating a president, what you really should be asking about the foreign policy, since there are always going to be good things and bad things, is on balance, is the team better off when the president leaves than when the president came? And how much of that is the president's doing? And by that logic, I think Obama has actually done pretty well. I think George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton both did well during their stints, but I think that George W. Bush inherited a pretty decent position and left, with the game going in the opposite direction.
Well, not to stretch the baseball metaphor too far here, but, I mean, that sounds like kind of a defensive posture to me. Don't screw up. Keep us in the game. Just don't mess up. Is that really how we want to define foreign policy?
Well, you know, it's actually a really good question, because the fundamental question you have to ask in that regard is, are things going in a good direction or a bad direction? Because if things are gradually, if a tide is with you, if things are gradually going, if you're drifting in the right direction, then not screwing up is actually a very big thing. And you'll actually do pretty well just by going with the flow. If the tide is against you, if you're drifting in the wrong direction, if you start out badly, then you need to actually make a change to pull things out. I would argue for the last 70 years or so, the United States actually has been doing pretty well. Ever since World War II, we basically have helped create and nurture a global liberal international order, essentially a partnership with other democracies and other liberal nations in which we trade with them, we protect them, and we take our little area of the world. It used to be the Atlantic Community, and gradually it's grown to include other areas as well. And we keep that a kind of zone of peace and prosperity. And bit by bit, things get a little bit better, life gets a little bit freer, the economy grows a little bit more in those areas, and those areas themselves expand to take over more of the world. And I think that basic trend has been a positive sort of decade by decade over that period. And so in that context, not screwing things up and not radically changing things is a wise conservatism. We're almost like the heirs to a great fortune, and our job is first and foremost not to screw it up, and second, to try to increase it over time.
Okay, so you mentioned the problems that President Obama inherited when he came into office, a couple of wars, an economy that wasn't doing very well, to say the least. But every president inherits the foreign policy of his predecessor, be it good or bad. So, you know, does President Obama get a pass because he inherited some problems?
He doesn't get a pass, and this is what Brett's going to argue in the next half hour, that Obama actually didn't get dealt too bad a hand to begin with, and so the time has long since been passed to blame things on George W. Bush. I don't think that actually is valid, because when you make major mistakes in foreign policy, like when you get involved in a bad war that you don't know how to end properly, when you screw up a major economic crisis, then it takes a long time for that to work its way out of the system. If you think how long Vietnam took, if you think how long the Iraq war is taking. And so when Obama came in, he not only had the immediate ends of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the financial crisis, but there was essentially a period of American expansion in the Middle East that that had gone wrong and had overstepped and overexpanded into areas and territory that we couldn't sustain. And so that pullback from an overexposed position and the withdrawal from an exposed salient, you might say, is something that's been playing out for a long time. And it's going to play out over the next few years as well, I think. And it's not pretty, but in the long run, it's better than where we were, let's say, in the middle years of the last decade, in which the Middle East was in crisis, but we were directly in the thick of things. The Middle East is still in crisis, but at least we've been pulled out of it a little bit.
Okay, so better being better for the U.S., not better necessarily for the world?
Well, it's a good question. I think better for the world, but not necessarily for the Middle East. So the one of the key things to keep in mind is what the standard of comparison is. The truth is that much of history has been war and poverty and political oppression, and keeping things relatively peaceful, relatively stable economically, relatively freer over time is ahead of the game in the past. And so we tend, however, to pocket those kinds of advances. And especially presidents who stay out of wars tend to be somewhat unsatisfying at the time, Eisenhower, Clinton, until you view them against the record of their successors who get back into wars, like Kennedy and Johnson or George W. Bush, when you realize just how bad it is, for example, to get into a war that you don't know how to win. So Obama has had to sort of essentially take a lot of criticism for staying out of wars in places like Syria, for letting Iraq go down a little bit, for keeping out of some of the turmoil in places like Libya and Yemen and elsewhere in the Middle East, for not actually directly confronting Russia aggressively in Ukraine. But I think he's done those things not because he's weak, not because he doesn't care about their fate, but because he doesn't actually see a way to constructively make things better in those areas. Nobody knows what to do about Libya. Nobody knows what to do about Syria. Nobody knows what to do about Iraq, frankly. And nobody knows really how to push Russia out of, let's say, Crimea right on its doorstep. And so what Obama has done is to say, you know what, these areas of the world are not necessarily the most important ones. They're somewhat on the strategic periphery. And keeping out of conflicts there that we can't actually win is the sort of safer and more prudent and wiser choice in the long run, as long as we can get our general alliance structure intact and moving forward, and keep out of a war with China and keep the world economy going forward. So I think those, in the long run, that will actually be seen better by historians than it appears in the present, where it looks like we're retreating and leaving some messes behind in some places around the world.
800-642-1234 is the number to call this hour. We're evaluating President Obama's foreign policy during his two terms in office as he comes his time in office comes to a close. 800-642-1234, talk@WPR.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment or a question there. We're in this half of the program getting the perspective of President Obama has performed the way a good middle relief pitcher has performed and has done generally a good job on foreign policy. We will get the opposing view in the second half of this hour from Brett Stevens. He'll have some different things to say. 800-642-1234. You know what? Since we'll only have Gideon Rose on for another 15 minutes or so, let's take some calls right now. We'll start in Janesville, where Kenneth is on the line. Kenneth, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Why are we so incompetent as far as understanding countries? I mean, take Iraq, where spent all this money and spent all these lives and got nothing from it. I mean, we didn't even know that there were Sunni and Shiite classes there. We could have made the whole Northern Africa and Middle East into our image and, you know, wiped our hands of the whole area.
All right, Kenneth, thank you.
That's actually a very good question. There's two different components to that, though. One is, why did we do such a bad job? And the other is, why didn't we recognize the complexities of the local situation? Because it's possible that I agree with you that we did not understand fully the challenges we were taking on in Iraq. The Bush administration knew what it didn't want, Saddam Hussein, but it didn't really know what it did want to see in Iraq afterwards. And when it got there, it sort of figured out that it would be much harder than expected to engineer a new Iraq. But by that point, it was too late because we were stuck there. I think that even, however, in retrospect, if we had had all the best experts, they wouldn't necessarily have helped us build a new Iraq, because sometimes it's just very, very hard to engineer another country's political development from the outside if you're only going to be there relatively temporarily and you're not prepared to literally colonize the entire country. So I think that the challenge is not just figuring out what places do you know enough about and what should you do on the ground, but where, if you don't actually know much, and if you're never going to know much and you're always going to be the outsider, where do you say, you know what, this, however unpleasant what's going on there is, we're going to stay out because we can't actually make it better. And I think that if you look at Syria now, Syria is in a terrible condition, obviously. It's a tragic human reality, and it's also a strategic mess. But the Obama administration has said, you know what, that's going to be true whether we're there or not, and we can't make it much better. So let's just stay out, recognizing, as it were, the limits of our knowledge and influence. It doesn't sound like a very attractive policy, but Iraq shows you what it would look like if we were actually deeply involved on the ground. And so it's sort of pick your poison kind of thing.
Kenneth, thanks so much for that call. 800-642-1234. We are talking about President Obama's foreign policy record in this hour. And in this first half of the show, Gideon Rose is my guest. He is the editor of Foreign Affairs and the Peter G. Peterson Chair, and he's giving us his take on the Obama foreign policy record. We'll get a different perspective in a little while later in the hour. So whichever side you're on this, please call in and let us know. 800-642-1234. The Obama foreign policy record is what we're talking about. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have more with Gideon Rose and with you if you choose to join us. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. And in this first hour of the program, we're talking about President Obama's foreign policy record. My guest in this portion of the show is Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs. And we have a lot of people on the phone who want to join us. Before we go to that, though, One of the fundamental tenets of America's foreign policy, at least as a lot of us have understood it, going back a number of decades, was that it was kind of our job to spread democracy around the world. Is that still true? And have we reached the point where we might have started to understand that not necessarily everyone is even ready for it, and that it may not always be a good thing?
That's a good question. It's not so much that it was our job to spread democracy, but it was that we wanted democracy to proliferate, and we hoped that others would join it. We never actually went to war explicitly for the purpose of democratizing other countries. We did so because we were attacked or we felt a strategic threat, but when we tried to leave behind democracies when we left. And I think that one of the things we've seen is that it's very hard to change other countries' political systems, but you can sometimes get what you want in the long run, even if you don't do it directly. And the example I would use there is something like Korea. We went into Korea to protect the South against the Northern invasion. We achieved a stalemate, and it was very unsatisfying at the time. And we left in place not just a communist regime in the North, but a somewhat authoritarian, nasty regime in the South. But over several decades of economic growth and social and political development, South Korea has become a thriving democracy. You ended up getting regime change even though you didn't go to war for that purpose. And I think that that's the kind of thing that shows what can happen through positive long-term developmental trends once you have a security guarantee, a wall in place, and protect the country and allow it of evolution and growth and development to take its natural course.
So, we've got a lot of callers, so let's get to those. Let's go to Sheboygan next and have Ron join us. Ron, good afternoon.
Yeah, I have two things on Libya and Syria real quick. I guess we'll start with Syria first. Obama's been saying he's going to train the rebels and this and that, and then we hear, oh, there's only so many rebels, like a few dozen. And the obvious reason is they said you cannot attack the Assad regime. So what's the whole point? The Assad regime, kills 500,000 people, and they want them to attack ISIS. ISIS isn't killing them. And why can't there be a no-fly zone? You say they want to stay out of it. They can do a no-fly zone like they did in Libya. And with Libya, the point was, what did Obama say that why we had to go into Libya? He said Gaddafi was going to go door-to-door in Benghazi. We have our own problems with Benghazi. And Gaddafi didn't do anything that we see that Assad's doing, and they had no debt. Their country was economically fine. They had no debt. Goldman Sachs owed them who knows how many billion. And, everyone had a house, and the whole Syria thing is just really breaks my heart.
Okay. Ron, we get it. We got to go because we need to get our guest's response to that. Syria and Libya.
So, Libya is interesting because in Libya, the Obama administration actually repeated the Bush administration's Iraq mistake in miniature, which is it knocked out a government without having a plan for what to do next. And the result was to trade sort of tyranny for chaos. That's not a good bet. And one of the things I think future presidents will be likely to do is to pause a little bit, because however bad the devil you know is, we now understand that the devil you don't know can be even worse. In Syria, one of the problems and the things I do fault the Obama administration for is, even when they make a calculation that it's not worth doing something, they can't keep their mouth shut. So they have to say something that sounds better than what they're actually doing. So first they say Assad has to go, even though they don't know what they're going to do in his place. Then they say, oh, we're going to train up rebels. In reality, the United States doesn't like Assad, it doesn't like most of the rebels, and the only people it actually likes are too weak to actually be major players in the war. And so we don't really have a good, strong Syria policy, because the players in that war who have a serious chance of winning are all variants of bad and worse. And so we're essentially staying on the sidelines. And that's the policy the administration has adopted. But it can't really admit that because it sounds too bad. So they make noises about doing something else, hoping that it will not sound as bad as and as callous as simply standing by. But that's actually what they're doing. And the result, of course, is that you end up with a credibility gap because you keep saying you're doing something, but you're not actually doing anything. And so people think that you're either a failure or you're delusional, when in fact you just can't admit that your policy is the lesser evil of staying out because you don't have a better answer.
Let's talk about the Iran nuclear deal, because that's one that that has been very controversial, at least from a political standpoint. What people are saying, well, the president made a bad deal. We're getting taken. You know, what is your view on the Iran deal?
I think it's kind of a shame how foreign policy has gotten caught up in the crazy domestic politics and partisan infighting in the U.S. Basically, these days in Washington, everybody knows if one party says something, the other party has to say it's the opposite, it's the devil. The Iran deal is a pretty straightforward, solid deal. It's neither the coming of the Messiah nor the, you know, the end of the world. It is essentially a deal to stabilize one part of the Iran file, the nuclear side of the Iran question, for a limited period of time in return for the lifting of the sanctions that were levied on that particular issue. It is not going to solve the Iran problem for good or all the Iran problems, but it will help stabilize and pause the nuclear program for at least a decade and more, which is something that other policy options hadn't managed to achieve. We were going in the wrong direction. So most people, actually, most national security experts, dispassionate ones, think that it's actually a pretty decent deal. It's not, it has to be supplemented by other policies, but it's not a terrible threat. And it's a legitimate response to a legitimate problem. Unfortunately, it's gotten caught up in the craziness of Washington these days, in which, you know, everything Obama does is, you know, going to bring about the disaster of the country. I think that in the long run, we'll see this as being a relatively solid, legitimate arms control deal, not dissimilar to some of the ones we signed with the Soviet Union. I don't think it's going to bring about the change in Iran that its advocates hope anytime soon, but it should lessen the threat for a little bit and leave us time to continue dealing with the region as it plays out.
And then last question for you, Gideon Rose. What about the relationship between the United States and Israel? That really seems to have soured during President Obama's time in office. What's going on there?
It has really soured, and it's soured for two reasons, both on the Israeli side and the U.S. side. There's no question that the Obama administration bungled some aspects of its relationship. It decided that Israel was at fault for some things and tried to pressure it without really having a particularly good plan for what to do. That was a mistake, and it just got the Israelis back up because you can't really pressure them too much. They'll just hunker down. But the Israelis have also essentially tried to manipulate U.S. politics directly and have essentially taken support for Israel, which has always been a bipartisan issue, and made it almost a kind of partisan Republican and anti-Obama issue. And that's actually a dangerous game for the Israeli government to play, I think, because it's not going to get them what they want. The real issue is Israel doesn't have an answer to either Iran or the Palestinian issue and wants to essentially kick those cans down the road, but the United States government feels that it's better to actually deal with those issues in some respects in the short and medium term. So the Israelis and the United States have different objectives on tactics. In the long run, we're still a strong ally, and I think the relationship will survive. But there's no question that these leaders aren't going to be breaking bread anytime soon in a very cordial way.
Okay. So circling back to the baseball metaphor we began with, the president's time as a middle reliever, are we getting to the ninth inning with the lead?
I don't think it's the ninth inning, but I think that, you know, we're in the sixth inning and we're slightly ahead. And the next we pitched out of a jam. We've put up some scoreless innings. We're still ahead. And the next pitcher is going to have a good position in which to sort of really close out the game.
All right. Gideon Rose, thank you for being with us today on the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you.
Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs, was our guest in this first half of the program. We're going to welcome now Brett Stevens, who's deputy editor of the editorial page for The Wall Street Journal, who wrote an opposing piece in Foreign Affairs about President Obama's foreign policy performance. Brett Stevens, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
It's good to be on.
So in your article, you say that Gideon Rose gives President Obama too much credit for inheriting the problems of his predecessors. Why?
Look, every president comes to office with a mixed bag. And if we have listeners here who have a bit of a longer memory than simply the financial crisis of 2008, they'll remember maybe that when Ronald Reagan became president, we had a stagflation. We had a situation where the Soviets seemed to be advancing, invading Afghanistan, the hostage crisis in Iran. Go back a little further and recall that when Eisenhower became president, he inherited a terrible war in Korea. So part of the mythology of the Obama administration has been that this president inherited an almost apocalyptically bad situation. That's a self-serving exaggeration that I think Gideon has used to make the record of this administration seem better than it has actually been.
So you say, okay, so every president should be judged on delivering what he promises. What has President Obama not delivered on?
Well, I mean, where do we start? Guantanamo, that would be closed. Relations with Russia, reset. Our good name in the Middle East would be restored. Remember the big Cairo speech he gave in the first months of his presidency. There's a long list of promises that the president made that he didn't deliver. The ones that and the promises where he did deliver, I think, are ones that I think many wise observers, including Democrats, are now taking a second look at, not least the complete withdrawal from Iraq, which has created the power vacuum now being filled by groups like ISIS.
I guess the response to that might be, well, how long could we have afforded to maintain that presence over there? I mean, we had, by some estimates, $1 trillion invested in Iraq and Afghanistan already, and many needs going unmet at home. What was he supposed to have done?
Well, look, cast your eye around the world. How long have we had a presence of American troops in Turkey, in Spain, in Germany, in South Korea, in Japan? The notion that the United States was bankrupting itself uniquely on the war in Iraq, or that maintaining a tripwire presence of, say, 15 or 20,000 troops was more than our economy could bear, just doesn't withstand even basic scrutiny. The larger point, which you've, I think, implicitly raised by your question, is the notion that there is a kind of trade-off between what we do abroad and what we do domestically. And you've heard the president often speak about his desire to do more nation-building at home, the suggestion being that we should retreat from areas around the world where perhaps we don't have vital issues or interests at stake, and focus on the home front. But I think every president since at least Harry Truman has known that this is a false dichotomy. Of course you have to be strong at home in order to be able to project power abroad. But what we've also learned is that if we are not secure abroad, these things end up affecting our security and prosperity at home. And that's been true at least since Harry Truman announced the Truman Doctrine in 1947. It's a false dichotomy which tends to lead to an isolationist belief that we should really try to minimize our global footprint in order to maximize prosperity at home. The truth is that a large global footprint goes hand in hand with a more prosperous country.
800-642-1234. We're talking about President Obama's foreign policy legacy, I guess you could say. What has he done right? What has he done wrong? We heard from Gideon Rose in the first half of the program. Brett Stevens is giving us a different viewpoint now, and we welcome yours. Let's take a few phone calls. Our phone banks are full here today, as I kind of expected they would be. And we'll go to Alan in Appleton. Alan, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One thing I'm tired of is hearing all politicians are the same. And I hear this from most people, but typically Republicans that I know will, and I will talk about things that I don't like about, say, President Obama, which I voted for, and they will never be able to admit anything that they find wrong with their candidate that they support. I've never heard one ever admit to anything. And, you know, I guess I don't really know how to deal with that when you can't admit that when you say all politics are the same, all politicians are the same, and they're not. The other thing you brought up, Kip, Guantanamo, and that's a perfect example. Republicans specifically made it so he could not close down Gitmo. So that's the perfect example of what have the Republicans done to help our president be a better president. You know, and the majority of people voted for him, so they should be supporting him. And when you look at, for instance, our Senator Ron Johnson, who has admitted, and I saw him say this, that he votes sometimes against what his constituency wants. So you have people that are going against their constituencies to do their own instead of doing what the people tell them to do.
Alan, thanks for this. Brett Stevens, what about the partisan nature of foreign policy today, how it's gotten wrapped up in domestic politics? It maybe to us, because we're living in this period, it seems like it's a lot worse. But it seems like we are experiencing a lot of that.
You know, I think that if you had, if we had a time machine and we could go back 40 years to say the debates over the Vietnam War, I guess 45 years, or go back even earlier to the days of, unfortunately, Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy, you would quickly recall that partisanship, when it comes to foreign policy, can be no less ferocious or ugly than when it comes to domestic issues. So there's this kind of mythology in America that somehow that partisanship ends at the water's edge. I'm a pretty close student of American foreign policy, and I can't think of a single instance, or I can think of very few instances, where that's true outside of national emergencies like the Second World War. Look, you know, it is important to be able to criticize your own side. I think that anyone who reads my column would see that I have written plenty of columns that have made right-leaning voters irate. It's also worth noting that when it came to the president's request for negotiating authority when it came to the Pacific trade deal, he won it. He won the vote thanks to overwhelmingly to Republican votes, not Democratic votes, who are largely against these trade deals or against free trade in general. It's important to be able, from time to time, to concede that your partisan opponent has a point, and I tried to do that in the space that I was given in my piece in Foreign Affairs. I mean, this is a president who unquestionably has gotten a few things right. I just think that the overall record is a fairly dismal one.
Mm-hmm. We talked in the earlier part of the hour about what has happened in Syria and what happened in Libya in terms of what the United States did. I want to get your take. Let's start with Libya first. We supported basically getting rid of Gaddafi in Libya, and Gideon Rose said, "Well, that was we made the same mistake that the Bush administration made on regime change." What would be your take there?
I guess my answer would be that we intervened in Libya half-heartedly, and we had next to no follow-up, especially when the administration became spooked, following the tragedy of the killing of Ambassador Stevens and our other three security personnel there. Libya, look, Gaddafi was one of the vilest dictators in the world. He was about to perpetrate in Benghazi what President Assad has perpetrated in Syria. I don't think we should be ashamed of our intervention, but the problem is that once you do intervene and there isn't any real effort to stand up the government that you have or a new government, a new dispensation, you're going to run into trouble. So, you know, you you can't, it's just not a matter of intervening and walking away. There's also an issue of follow-up. And I have to say I fought both parties here. I don't think the administration followed up, but I think the Republicans were so dead set, or many of the Republicans were so dead set against the intervention in the first place, that they didn't give him much political incentive to do anything about it.
Let's take a call here. Mike is with us from Franklin. We'll go to him next. Mike, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I have a question for your guest. In the last week, they played a tape from Dick Cheney from 1994, and they asked him at that time, how come they didn't go into Baghdad then and take out Saddam Hussein? And his response was, you have to be careful. If you topple certain leaders, all of a sudden you can turn the whole area into a mess. You create a vacuum. And what did we do in the second Gulf War? That's exactly what we did. We created a vacuum. We created a mess. And I just don't understand why people are still considering people like Dick Cheney an expert. Just watch the tape, what he said in 1994. Thank you.
Mike, thanks for the call. Brett Stevens?
Well, I mean, I'm not here to defend Dick Cheney. I think that if he were if he were asked that question, he'd say we had this intervening event known as September 11th. It completely changed our attitudes about our risk factors in the Middle East. So that's what I suspect he would say. Look, on the larger point, though, you know, the issue is once you go into a country, how is it that you can intervene and stabilize in a way that doesn't end up overtaxing, in the broadest sense of the word, your resources, your ability to act effectively, both in the region and act effectively politically? That's an extraordinarily tricky question. I mean, I think people are deceiving themselves now and saying that, you know, we had it all under control in the Middle East so long as Saddam Hussein was in power. That certainly wasn't anyone's view at the time, Republican or Democratic. And it's probably mistaken given what we know about what happened in the Middle East after that, the basic, you know, the crumbling of practically an entire civilization that I think would have unfolded one way or the other. But you know, the great question is, you do face genuine risks in the Middle East where you are where you probably will need to use military force in some way in order to prevent matters from becoming massively worse, and Syria is a perfect example of that. But then how can you intervene in a way that gets you what amounts to a kind of a second best result, not trying to turn all these countries into Switzerland's, into model democracies, but ensuring that there is at least some kind of stabilizing presence that doesn't lead you to the kind of chaos you have now? And I think the answer is there is no one answer. I think you need to be very country specific. I think you have to judge what are the risks. I would have argued a long time ago that Syria, because of its ethnic composition, because of its geographic location, because of its strategic relationships with Russia and Iran, was going to descend into the kind of chaos that we have now. And that's not something we can be indifferent to, especially as hundreds of thousands of refugees, maybe millions eventually, flow out of the country, potentially to Europe. On the other hand, we don't want to go in and own Syria. So how do you find a middle way? I think that's the essence of intelligent policymaking. And one of the ways in which I think the Obama administration has gone wrong is it reminds me of an episode of Seinfeld where George Costanza figures out that everything he's done in his life is a mistake, so he just decides to do the opposite. And I sometimes feel, looking at the Obama administration's foreign policy, that its view was, if we just do the opposite of Bush, we're going to get it right. Well, it doesn't. I don't think life works that way, and I don't think foreign policy works that way either.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more with Brett Stevens, and we have more callers who want to join us. You could be one of them at 800-642-1234, or you could post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about President Obama's foreign policy record. Is it a good one? Does he get a passing grade, a failing grade, a middling grade? What do you think? 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about President Obama's foreign policy record. Brett Stevens is my guest in this segment, deputy editor of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. His piece, along with that of Gideon Rose, kind of bracketing the opinions on the president's foreign policy performance. And we're talking about that now. We've only got about 8 or 9 minutes left of the hour. Brett Stevens, I want to make sure that we cover a couple of really key things. We've been talking about the Middle East, and certainly that's just this huge hairball that we're looking at. What about the U.S. relationship with Israel? And Gideon Rose faulted the Obama administration for some of that. But what about the relationship with Israel? What could we have done differently there? And are we completely at fault, or does Israel have to take some responsibility for this as well?
I don't think in any relationship, I can think of very few relationships where someone is utterly blameless and someone else is completely at fault. But I would argue that the administration thought that it could strong-arm the Israeli government in a way that was ultimately counterproductive to the very things that this administration was trying to achieve. Above all, creating the kind of trust between leaders, the kind of trust between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu that could have induced Israel to make the sorts of concessions that the administration wanted to nudge it towards. The trust fell apart on the one hand after I think the president gave Netanyahu very little credit for breaking with the kind of the ideological reflexes of his party and accepting the idea and the need for a two-state solution. He took that concession from the prime minister and then pounced harder. But trust really broke down, I think, in 2013 when the president walked away from his red line in Syria. And I think, by the way, this goes beyond just the issue of U.S.-Israel relations. I think at that point, a lot of countries came away with the firm idea that American assurances, or at least this president's assurances, when it came to the use of American military force, were bluffs. They were hollow. They couldn't be relied on. And I think that message echoed not just in Jerusalem, but in Riyadh, in many other capitals, that American guarantees were shaky at best. So that was profoundly problematic, because if we're going to have effective diplomacy, we need to make sure that we have that kind of trust between leaders, the sense that the American president is as good as his word.
And then quickly, the Iran nuclear deal.
I think it's one of the most catastrophic agreements that the United States has signed in the last 40 years, if not longer. And it's not simply because it gives Iran a legal right and pathway to achieve near nuclear capability by the time my youngest child is in college, but because I think, as the Saudis have been telling us very publicly, as a matter of fact, no longer even privately, these sorts of concessions that have been made to Iran are ones that they are going to seek in their turn. So it's not simply a matter of having an Iran that may be close to having nuclear capability by the time my daughter is 21 years old. But it will be the Saudis, it will be the Turks, it could potentially be the Egyptians. And so you'll suddenly find a Middle East with four or five nuclear or near-nuclear states, all of them at daggers drawn with one another. And that's inherently destabilizing. That's an inherently dangerous situation. And this goes to the larger issue of President Obama's foreign policy, which is looking around the world today. Can anyone listening on the show say, yeah, the world is really a much safer place now? I feel good about the way our relations are with Russia. I don't mind what the Chinese are doing in the South China Sea. I'm at ease with the creation and the rise of ISIS. I'm not disturbed by the refugee tragedy, the calamity of the outflows of refugees from Syria. I really think that the world is a kind of in a placid state. I don't think anyone listening on this show would say that. Now, we can have a debate about how much the president is to blame for that, but it's hard to make the case that after 7 years of an Obama administration, the world is in a better state than it was 8 years ago.
Let's take some calls here. Dan is with us from Franksville. Dan, good afternoon.
Yeah, I think the whole narrative is not even 90% off. I think it's 100% off. It's almost like watching a Shirley Temple movie because everything's basically fraudulent. He just says the Saudis have been telling us certain things. The Saudi government is one of the worst dictators, tyrannical. It makes Saddam look like a wonderful, nice guy and stuff. And he's telling us our friends, the Saudis, basically. I mean, this is boring on insanity. They talk about Iran. You know what I mean? We're worried about Iran. Well, they had a democracy there. They had a president. The United States overthrew it and went a dictatorship. And as far as Iraq, you think they're going to be upset a little bit when they go in there, they invade, they say, okay, we're going to take over all the oil industries and we're going to privatize them and take away basically what's been your wealth for the last, you know, two or three decades. And you think the people are going to go, oh, they're here to help us, but they're firing off the only money that we have coming into this country. I mean, like, the whole narrative is way off. And the previous, not just this guy, the previous guy, liberals, the ones they call liberals, the nice guys, he's way off, too. He's just like this guy here. But, you know, if he really believes it, that's fine, but he's either naive or fake. There can't be nothing in between. That's all.
All right, Dan, thanks for that perspective. Quite a bit to chew on there. Brett, if you choose to.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's precisely because I don't like the Saudi regime that I don't think we should be encouraging an arms race in the Middle East that would tempt the Saudis to get a nuclear weapon. By the way, the notion that Iran was a democracy in 1953 is a fairly ludicrous notion historically. But I'm gonna leave that to, you know, to one side. It's worth actually kind of knowing what you're talking about before sounding off. Look, it's important in foreign policy to try to deal with the world as it is. And when we look around the world, we see a lot of countries where we have no problems having close relationships, whether it's with Britain or with South Korea or other Israel, other mature democracies. There are countries that we're going to have a very hard time having any kind of relationship with because their views are antithetical and their values are antithetical to American values. There are a lot of countries that, frankly, fall into a kind of a frenemies class, to use a term my kids would use. And you have to figure out a way in which you're going to have to deal with them. We have had a relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia since Franklin Roosevelt's time in the mid 1940s. They remain essentially the world's swing oil producer. On the other hand, they're a very problematic regime for all the reasons which I think even this caller is probably familiar with. How do you have a policy that nudges their country towards a more open-minded reform process when it comes to women, when it comes to minorities, that actually contributes to regional stability, not instability? How do we use our leverage there to make for a somewhat more positive direction in the Middle East? And you just, you know, this is not like who you choose to have as your friends in college or who do you choose to hang out with at a ball game. This is about how the world's only superpower tries to maintain some form of global order, some sense that there are rules, there are standards, some way of steering the world towards greater prosperity and openness while being cognizant of the limitations on our power and the need for us to choose between very difficult alternatives. That's what foreign policy is all about. And what we've learned since 1945 is we can't wish the world away. We can't say, to hell with all of you, you're just a bunch of rascals. we're going to have to deal with you, and we're going to have to assume a position of leadership and responsibility. I think the lesson of the Obama years is that when you try to retreat from that position, when you create power vacuums, whether it's in eastern Syria or South China Sea, those vacuums get filled by very nasty characters, and eventually the problems wash up on our shores. So we can't shrink from the responsibilities we have, and we have to deal with it in some, you know, intelligent, muscular, thoughtful fashion. And I think, at least on this point, for all of our differences, Gideon and I are in complete agreement.
All right. Well, you know what? I think one thing we'll have to agree on is that this hour is over because the clock is the master of all of us. Brett Stevens, thank you so much for being a guest today on the Kathleen Dunn program. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Brett Stevens is deputy editor of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. Gideon Rose, who was on earlier, is the editor of Foreign Affairs. There are a pair of columns in Foreign Affairs magazine that this program was based on, assessing the foreign policy performance of President Barack Obama as he approaches the end of his second term in office. So if you wanted to check those columns out, you could go over to foreignaffairs.com and look at those articles. This program was produced by K.P. Whaley, who also handled on-air production. Also, thanks to Michelle Good for her efforts on behalf of the show today. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. My understanding is that Kathleen will be back tomorrow. I'm John Munson, and we'll have another hour for you, so stick around. We'll be back after the news. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.